This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? Learn more about Wisconsin's cheese-making history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're delighting in the creepy, the spooky, the skin-crawling aspects of food history and culture.
Give yourself over to man's more hedonistic tendencies, and you wouldn't be making it to the great beyond. The Sin Eater's job was to ensure that you did.
In modern horror, audiences have been captivated by the isolation, mystery, and terror of rural life.
And so one of these preparations is actually taking oak bark, stuffing it into a cow skull, and burying that cow skull in a creek for a year.
I would argue that their evil went hand in hand with their marketing strategy. I'm not saying they had an excuse, but in order to make bananas work, they were deluded. They had to do these terrible things.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Valerie's dancing. We're just kicking off the podcast today with a party in the studio.
It's a party.
I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Valerie Lomas.
And you are listening to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers who make the food industry such an interesting world to live and work in. Valerie, what's new? What's new in your life?
Oh, geez. I feel like I'm a little on the spot. Honestly, for me, it's just been a lot more recipe developing, recipe testing. I had my first story and recipe published on Food and Wine yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And also recording some videos for something coming up soon.
Something top secret.
Is a secret, but I will share it very soon.
What's the Food and Wine article?
I'm actually talking about when I went to Santa Fe earlier in the year, and I learned so much about chilies. They're actually like one of the things that came out of the Americas. So I'm thinking about like harvest season and apples and Thanksgiving. And I'm like, you know what? Chilies are like really American, like in the most fundamental way. So I paired apples and green chilies and made apple fritters and told a story about Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Wow. Sounds delicious.
What have you been up to, Ethan?
Well, I just got back from a big trip last week, right before our show last week. I was in Spain to visit our pimenton supplier, and then Turkey, and then Afghanistan, and then Zanzibar, Tanzania. So it's just kind of been getting back in the normal swing of things in New York and getting ready for the big holiday season. Spices.
Yeah. Are you having reverse culture shock?
Reverse culture shock. I think I spend my whole life in reverse culture shock. I'm just like always, I never know where I am. Which actually is a nice segue to introduce our guests for today's episode. Majid Ali, who is a blogger, the Cineman, a baker, and the winner of the Sever Blog Award, the best blog of the year in 2018. Is that right?
Yes.
And Rachel Gurjar, who is the test kitchen manager and food editor at the Feed, and a blogger and YouTuber and food star in her own right. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so excited to be here.
And you've both had stories of career change, which is our excuse to bring you onto the podcast, even though we just wanted to talk to you. Majid, why don't you start? Give us a quick background on your multiple careers, the ones that you have now, the ones that you've had before.
And welcome to New York, because you are, recently arrived from the United Arab Emirates, and you're just here on vacation, so we're glad we were able to snag you for our podcast.
Thank you.
So welcome to the Big Apple, and Brooklyn in particular.
I just love the city.
You love the city?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a good time of year to be here also.
The weather is really nice. Yeah. I mean, just coming from the desert and the weather is so hot. to experience the cold a little bit is just like amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like as a baker, talk about that. I want to hear a little bit about your inspiration. Like what is the inspiration behind your blog? Because you share really recipes that are not only beautifully shot and you take all of the photos yourself, but the ingredients, it's a really nice play with a lot of traditional Middle Eastern ingredients and then a lot of techniques and ingredients that we find here So what's like the inspiration behind your blog?
I think the inspiration, it's all about the food that I grew up with, you know, and all the spices and all the ingredients. And, you know, like, for me, it's like, I feel like I have to bring something in the middle. Like, whenever I travel, like, for example, the banana bread. Like, when I'm really, really in love with the banana bread, because it always reminds me when I used to be a little kid, we used to go to the grocery store next to our house and get, like, you know, a banana wafer. And it's really, really delicious. So, you know, I think it's a really, really great, like, to, you know, to experiment the banana bread, for example, with cardamom, with cinnamon, or probably going to eat some, like, mix it with date molasses, maybe, in a way that, you know, to have the food, like, I mean, like, to make the food in your own way and to make it more personal. Like, you know, it has something to do with your background and with your culture and, you know, the ingredient you have. So that was really big inspiration for me to write my blog.
Yeah, I mean, I love that because I've definitely made my share of banana bread. And I would have never, I mean, you see cinnamon, you might see nutmeg, but brown sugar, you would never think like date molasses or cardamom. And that sounds like so delicious and just inspired. So, I mean, so what were you doing before baking? Because you're not a... You're not like a classically trained pastry chef, right?
No.
But you did go to, you went to college for, and you went to law school.
I did. You know, when you're like 15 years ago, I don't know if it was the right choice to do that or just like, you know, to go to the law school because, you know, back in the days, I wasn't really confident enough like to make my own choices. Mm. Like most of the time you just ask your parent, what is the best for me? Am I going to make a lot of money out of it? Or just like, you know, is it like a really good for living? And then you just go there. And 15 years ago, I mean, like choosing a career is just like, you know, the options that you have are really, really limited. You know, it's not like something that, you know, you don't want to go and do something really, really risky because, you know, it's just like it's like a weight that's gonna crush me. I don't want to do that.
I mean, I think that's pretty common with people who end up in law school. We are typically the risk averse. We are typically the risk averse types, and previous lawyers we have had on the podcast have all confirmed this. So, and we are all like, well, we don't know if we made the right decision, but it happened.
Exactly.
But you know, you obviously transitioned from that, and you found this beautiful way to express yourself.
Yes, I mean, it's a like just studying rights and law and just like you just end up by creaming sugar and butter and just, you know, you're just like, oh, that's really, really cool and that's really fulfilling. It makes me really, really happy. But then I realized that I think there's some point in my life, like I wasn't really sure if I love baking, but then when I was doing my master's degree and the day I handed over my my master's degree letter, I just like kind of asked myself, I really didn't feel like the sense of achievement, like I've did something. Mm. I didn't really feel like, you know, I just filled the void inside me that I just want to do it. I just, you know, no, it's not for me.
Were there food blogs that you read when you were in school? Where did the idea come from to write?
Okay, so I'll tell you the story of it because, you know, food blog is not really popular in Middle East. Not Middle East, I would say like in Gulf region because, you know, people consider themselves as a food blog. They just, when they have Instagram and they just like write a post and just put the recipes in the post and like, that's it. We don't want to read the story. We don't want to know your story. We don't want to hear about what do you think about the recipe. Just give us the recipe. That's it. But then, you know, I ask myself, like, there's a story behind it. There is some reason that I need to share the recipe. My thoughts, my idea, I mean, to share some of the culture. And the thing behind it is, you know, 6 years ago, in Gulf region, I would say somehow it's culturally forbidden for a man to practice baking. Because, you know, they don't look at the man as a baker, but it was really confusing for me because, you know, whenever we go to the bakery, I just go to the restaurant, like we see a lot of male chefs baking. And male just bakers just like, you know, bake breads and stuff, which is really confusing. Like, how come this is not socially acceptable?
And I was really intimidated because, you know, I was really, really fragile back in the day because I didn't have this confidence, you know, just to go out there and present myself as a baker. So I just practiced secretly in the kitchen. I didn't share this to anyone. And then one day in Ramadan, I remember I went to my friend's iftar, and I just made like a strawberry cheesecake. And then I served them served the cheesecake, and my friend came to me like, you have to do something with that. Like, you just either open a restaurant or just like a bakery or just like, you know, share the recipes with people. And I know deep down inside, I'm not really good at business and just like open a bakery because, you know, it's really hard. I mean, but also it's really, really risky. So I thought of starting a blog, and it was, you know, like, I just stood there and asked myself, how is it going to be? Like, what are you going to share? What are you going to do? But then, you know, I said, I'm just going to read some of blogs. I'm just going to see how they share the stories and how the ingredients and how they write it and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And just, you know, I said to myself, let's do it. And the name of the cinnamon came to me when I just, the first time I baked the banana bread, because I was really, really in love with the cinnamon. So I like the cinnamon. So, oh, okay, the cinnamon. Oh, I love the name of the cinnamon. So just let's just do it. Let's just write down the cinnamon as a blog name. And then I think it's, you know, since I couldn't express my feelings through my mouth, I think it's like somehow I delivered the you know, my feelings through writing and through the photography and through sharing the recipes and the stories, which is really, really cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing that you've been able to do that and to be the first food blogger in the Emirates, maybe?
I wouldn't call myself that, you know. I just
one of the first.
Is
that fair?
Oh,
maybe the first to win a Savour.
Yeah, there we go.
Food blog award.
I'll take that.
Okay.
And Rachel, what about you? What's tell us your origin story.
Yeah, like how did you end up as the test kitchen manager at the Feed? Or how did you even end up here in New York?
Okay. So I did my bachelor's in marketing and went on to do my master's in broadcast journalism and communication. And after that, I worked for a PR agency for about 2 years. And I just did it because I fell into the job and I was doing it. But I had a couple of side hustles going on. So I used to own a jewelry designing business. I went to drama school in the summer and I was like still figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. Then I switched jobs to like a second PR company. And that's when I realized that my life right now was A, complacent. This is not my passion. And I needed to find something that I really love. And I just sat down one day and thought about where I wanted to be 10 years from now. And I honestly didn't have a clue. So I made a list of things that I really enjoy doing when I'm not working and the things that I absolutely don't enjoy. And a recurring theme that I started to see was food. Because I realized like all of my free time, I was either watching my mom cook or helping her or like trying to make, you know, different recipes. And that's when I kind of told my parents that I know you guys are going to get really mad at me, but I promise this will be the last degree and my last like type of education that I'm going to do. And I made a list of culinary schools that I wanted to go to and presented a thing to my dad, like a pitch. I'm like, all right, please hear me out. And, you know, my parents are super supportive and I'm so lucky like that. And my dad said, he's like, all right, Rachel, I'll do this one last thing for you, but you have to promise me that you're going to try to make it. Like, you have to give more than 100%. And I was like, all right. So it took a whole year of, like, preparation and working in restaurant kitchens in India when, you know, like, service level jobs or kitchen jobs back then were just, women didn't do it. So it was a huge, like, work culture shock for me when I started working in a restaurant there.
When you say women didn't do it, was it like, can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'm curious. So, you know, women in India cook, I'm talking like 5 years from now, 5 years ago, right? Like right now, like the food scene has changed and it's become a popular thing. But women in India, like they'll usually cook at home or they basically cook at home. Like there's not a lot of women chefs. There are a couple of popular ones, but any type of like restaurant or commercial cooking is done by men. And if you went into the back of a restaurant kitchen, you would not find a woman there. Yeah. So when I was doing like my internship or like that was a requirement for culinary school, like everyone was shocked that I was there and like they were confused, like, why am I there? So, you know, it was kind of like hard to explain to them. And that's just how it is. Like if you want to make money in food back then, it was like men did it. It was like right. Women just don't do it. Also because the people who like the service industry people usually like they don't come from very well-off backgrounds and, you know, they don't speak English. They're not very educated.
They probably don't have master's degrees yet, you know. But
they're working very hard and, right. You know, like their way of thinking is different. So I guess that's one of the reasons. And my dad warned me. He was like, Rachel, you are trying to enter a field that's very demanding physically, mentally. You're not going to have any days off. You'll have to work weekends. And, you know, you have to be ready for it. And my dad had some experience with that because he had a hotel management degree, but he, like, worked front of house. So he knew the service world a little bit. And I was like, no, bring it on. Like, you know, I feel like this is what I want to do. And that's when I came here to go to school. And I, all through school too, I worked, you know, I worked on campus. I worked off campus. After graduating, I moved to the city and I had to like make a choice. So either work in restaurant kitchens or which honestly on a minimum wage, I was not going to be able to survive. I had decided I don't want to take any more financial help from my parents. So I decided to work front of house. So I worked front of house. And when I was there, like there's certain, after certain periods in my life, I try to like reevaluate what I'm doing. And I was like, all right, so owning a restaurant is not my goal. I still love to cook. I'm not cooking right now. I'm still working in the restaurant industry. And this is giving me great experience, but I need to cook. So I was doing like private chefing gigs and I would work in catering kitchens on the weekend. But I needed to figure out a way to like express myself creatively and still be cooking and meet people. So that's when I started exploring food photography and styling. So my actually younger brother gifted me a very base level camera and I started...
What kind of camera was it?
It was a Rebel T5, like the most initial Canon one. And I just started watching lots of tutorials on YouTube and trying to teach myself how to take pictures of food. And I came to realize that, oh, I love this. And, you know, there is a curry. You could make a curry in this, so.
What was it about the communication aspect of food that appealed to you? The writing, the photography?
So I can...
like, because you have this background, right? I do. In communication and broadcast journalism. So, yeah, like, how did that kind of present itself in?
So I realized that I have things to say, but I've not said them. Right? Like you cook for people, but like when you're cooking in a restaurant kitchen, you're making other people's recipes. And while that's great experience and I respect people who work in restaurants so much because it takes a lot, I just realized that, you know, living in a different country, I was like missing my culture and I was, there was like so much that I wanted to share about where I came from. And as I started my blog and started writing, I was like, oh my God, like, this is like really cool. It can be hard to express yourself in terms of like writing too, because like English is not my first language. So it was a challenge, honestly, even though I have a communication degree, like, you know, that very much pertain to like things and media in India. And here it's different. So I took it up as a challenge. You know, I try to improve my writing skills almost every day in the sense that, you know, try to write something. And I really liked it. And when I wrote something heartfelt, people responded to that well and they were able to relate to it mostly. So like when I put out something and when people were able to relate to it and it brought some kind of like joy to them or started a conversation, that's what I think drew me in even more.
Manjot, you were nodding through that
Yeah.
What has your experience been of writing in a language that's not your first? And
it's not my first language, and I didn't go to like a private school to like a private English school. Like the new generation now in Middle East, they go to English private school in order to, you know, to learn English. And English is not my first language, and I didn't have the privilege to go like to private school because I'm too old.
But you taught yourself, right?
I taught myself through the music and the movies and the books. But right now, I really, you know, I just like, you know, I just buy a book by like a food writer and just, you know, read it. And then just like when there's like a word that I do not like, oh, this word is really new to me, I just need to figure out and just like go through Google and just like find this word. And then just like bring like a pen and write next to it the translation in Arabic to know.
And who are some food writers that you enjoy reading or that inspire you or speak to you?
I know this is like really, really typical, but I really love Nigel Olason. Nigel Olason is an amazing writer. Currently I'm reading A Half-Baked Idea by Olivia Potts. I really could relate to her because, you know, she was going through, you know, when her mom passed away and she discovered, you know, the baking, because I could relate to it because my dad, like, 2 years ago, he passed away, and, you know, and I'm a baker, so I just really, really loved what she's writing because, you know, I could sense the grief in her writing and I could relate to it, which is, you know, very, very inspiring.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what Rachel was mentioning about when you are being vulnerable as a writer, as someone who's creating something, and you share that, that resonates with people in a way that's way more profound than just, hey, this is a delicious recipe and you should make it because it's the best.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree.
And Majed, you write your blog in both languages.
Yes, I do.
So tell us a little bit about that, how you decided to do that and how the recipes in both languages differ or...
They're the same. They're the same because, you know... All right, they don't. But the thing is, it's really hard sometimes to find, you know, I would say like a word of, you know, when you go through a method like whisking, you know, and a creaming and a stuff, like when you just find a like translation for it in Arabic, it's somehow it's really struggling and some people don't get it. And I found out that like, you know, quite sometime just like in trying to find the word. And sometimes when I translate it in Arabic to find a really, really ancient word in Arabic and just like, what is this word? I mean, what does it mean? I mean, like, it's like a creaming. So I just like, I'm using English word in like in my website in Arabic. So it's kind of really hard. But as I said, when we were having lunch, we just figured that a lot of people now are going through the blog, the English blog, and just reading and, you know, going through the website. And there is a lot of interacting in my English blog more than the Arabic one.
Even people who are themselves native Arabic speakers.
Yes. So I thought that I would stop blogging in Arabic and just like focus them on in English, because I think people could, you know, it's much easier to write. And, you know, for me, because I need some time for myself to spend, you know, to take care of myself, to take care of my mom, and just, you know, to focus on my book, because it's time consuming. So.
So you're writing a book? I was just about to ask that next.
Oh, well, so. I answered the question, so yeah, I made it easy for you.
Perfect. I think another point of similarity between your experiences that I want to make sure we talk about is how you've each challenged traditional gender norms around cooking.
Yeah.
I mean, you both spoke about this earlier, but Majed, men don't cook sweet.
Nope.
Sweet baked goods.
No, they don't bake.
They bake bread. Maybe.
Oh, well, it's just a flour. Well, it's, you know, it's, or like a flour and just like butter. So it's like it's really similar, but you know, yeah.
But different, yeah.
Well, and then Rachel, likewise, your experience of challenging those assumptions in restaurants in India, how do each of you feel like that has carried forward into your work today? And how have you either acknowledged or resisted or ignored? How have you handled that pressure?
Just by working really hard and being that person, if, you know, I do get messages from time to time from young women in India being like, all right, so like you're doing all of these amazing things. How did that happen? So I do take the time to, you know, share tips with them, my journey with them, and tell them there is no shortcut to working hard. You know, it looks glamorous and it looks easy, but there's a lot of hard work and grit and perseverance that goes into this. So, you know, all of this, like, you are seeing me on like IGTVs, and I do work for a food media company, and I have this blog and a small following. It didn't like happen overnight. It's been 5 years of me just working weekdays, weekends, any free time. So I would say, like, start by, you don't have to have an expensive camera. You don't even have to have a blog. Like right now, you know, you have access to all of these social media channels. Just start by taking photos with your phone. Invest time in learning a skill that you want to be good at, because there's no other way. You know, when people are like, oh, you photograph food and like you do it so well. I'm like, yes, because when I was unemployed and I was making the transition, I did stay up till 4 a.m. trying to figure out what the hell is an f-stop.
How many pictures do you take for every one that you post or release to the public?
So, a lot.
How many times do you press the button for every one public
picture? I mean, sometimes like a set, right? If you're, it's one recipe and there'll be like 300, like 350 photos. I'm like trying to bring the number down, because if you go in with a plan, then you know exactly what you want out of that shoot, what angle. So then you try to like take fewer photos, and that's good for you because you don't have to sort through everything and have all of this extra data. So, yeah.
I think it depends on the mood as well.
Also that.
Yeah. Like sometimes, like, I already spent some time on this recipe. Now I need to take a picture. Oh, God, help me.
Yes.
So, Majed, tell us about your experience with those, the gender roles and the ways that you've challenged them and the ways that
You know, right now, well, before that, I would, like, just, they addressed me, you know, they called me a housewife. They just called me, you know, like, like a cupcake girl and stuff. But, you know, for me, like, I'm just like, you know, you can say whatever you want to say. I'm just like, I'm done. Like, you know, I have one life to spend. I decided to spend the life on doing what I wanted. What I want to do. And, you know, the time has changed now, and like I just get a lot of messages from people like, you do a lot of, you do beautiful stuff. I mean, do you take your pictures by yourself? I'm like, yes, I do take pictures of myself. Like, yeah, I really found a hard time to take pictures of myself for my food. I'm just like, you know, I'm like, well, you gotta do it. I mean, you have to spend some time, and you have to practice. You know, that's the thing. If you wanna achieve something, if you wanna do something, you have to practice, because it's food photography, baking, cooking is the craft. Like, you have to practice in order to nail it. It's not like something you're gifted. I don't know. It's really complicated.
No, absolutely. And one thing that you're both talking about a lot is the time that you've invested, right, into building these platforms, like Rachel with your YouTube channel and your social media, and Majed with your blog and stuff. And you guys both actually have like whole other jobs, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, so how do you, like, what are some struggles with that balance, with finding that balance between giving, you know, all of yourself to this passion of yours and also pursuing other professional goals, whether, you know, and that might correspond with what you're doing, or it might just be to kind of help pay the bills or have retirement or health insurance, which are all very noble and valid things that we all deserve.
Absolutely. So what I've like come to realize, especially this past year, is when you genuinely like doing something and you also do that as like your full-time job, the lines get blurry, and you know, you don't know how to say no, because you're like, all right, you like want to be that person who, like, because like you know how to do something and you know you're asked to do it, and whether it be in your 9-to-5 job or outside of that, you take on so much, and then it starts to show. Like, stress manifests in so many different ways, and when you're just going like go, you don't notice that, and then one day it comes out in some of the other forms. So what I'm trying to do now is learning how to say no and setting boundaries. right, for myself and also so that people understand, right, yes, like, she is capable of doing all this, but the weekend or this particular day is, like, her day, and unfortunately she's not available to communicate or, like, cater to X, Y, and Z. So Setting boundaries and, like, self-care. And I know, like, self-care is, like, such a broad, like, spectrum of things.
It's a buzzword.
Yes.
What is self-care?
I mean, for me, honestly, it is just sitting down with a cup of tea and breathing. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have to be a crazy massage or... And that is good.
Right.
I would definitely not have to
turning
treat
that
myself.
Down. Yeah.
But just, like, being still. Because we're not still anymore, you know? So for me, it's like sitting in the evening with a cup of tea, trying to read. I don't read as much as I like to read, but calling my parents back in India and talking to them, like, that is self-care for me. But, you know, what about you?
I'm really happy that you mentioned learning saying no, because that's the thing. Because, you know, I think it's just like you're giving yourself a break by doing that. And like... I feel like there's a lot of people, it really requires a lot of confidence to say no to people, and that's really great. For me, I learned after my dad passed away, like, I need to focus more on myself. Back in the days, I was really, I was really, really focusing on, like, my social media, my Instagram, my blog, and I have to post, like, every year, every week, or probably every 3 days, and just, like, you know. And then I'm like the things that used to matter before doesn't matter after when you lose someone. That's what I learned. Like, I need to spend more time with my mom. I need to learn. I mean, I'm like to spend more time with my friends, to read a book, to be with yourself, to travel, to to have a good time. That's really how I describe it as a self care. You know, it doesn't have to be a massage or just like going on a trip. That's the thing. You know, you have to. You have to take care of your soul.
Yeah.
We're going to take a 2-minute break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th. For a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Join us to explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, where you'll taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Join the party. Tickets are available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
Hi, and welcome back to Why Food. Valerie here and Ethan, and we are here talking to Rachel Gujar and Majid Ali. So I think it's really interesting, Rachel, because you mentioned, you know, you work for a media company now, a food media company. And, you know, we're at this really interesting time. There's this kind of transition that seems to be happening with you know, more traditional print magazines, newspapers, and then this digital realm mm-hmm. that we are in constantly, right? Yeah. So working for a digital media company, like, how do you see that playing out? And, like, what do you think about this? Like, what do you think about where we're headed with media?
I think digital media is not going anywhere. It's here to stay. Like, you know, with the way technology is, like, progressing, and we're all the time on our phone and
screens.
Like, it's here to stay, and it's only going to grow and become bigger. Having said that, traditional media is also important, like print media. You know, people still enjoy that.
Feel like you guys are kind of getting, like, does digital media get the respect it deserves?
No, it doesn't. It's sometimes... Amajit, you were saying something. Go ahead.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
No, it doesn't, because, you know, traditional media has been around for so long. Sometimes I feel like what we do in digital media is not taken seriously because it's not in print form in some way. And that's a huge part, because you know, like, what it takes to get something out there, whether digitally
right,
or
to
in
get
print
something
form.
Published.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like the more the groups in print media talk about or, like, collaborate or get with the people working in food media, I feel like that's when you can find a healthy, happy medium where neither of them, like, feels threatened by each other, and everybody is, like, seen as an authority in their own fields, because both are important. Both are here to stay in some way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, I feel like there's always going to be books, I hope, because I do
I
like reading
so
a book.
I hope so, too.
So, yeah, I think it's just about, like, communication, right, and talking and supporting each other and finding, like, a middle ground to
People
coexist.
Say that, but they don't mean it.
What does that mean exactly? And, Ethan, you look like you have some thoughts over there.
I have no thoughts on
this. Ethan has no thoughts.
I have nothing to say on this subject.
I think now people, they just use the digital media to show, you know, their not real image. They always aspire for perfection, you know. It's all about the beautiful pictures. It's all about the beautiful life. It's all about we're happy. We're just living the American dream, probably, but that's not true. That's not really true. I mean, you have to be honest to yourself. You have to, I mean, share the grief, share your sadness, share your happiness. It's just like that's what it's supposed to be. And I think what it's really like, what's so special about print, because people care about what they write more than they present, because now it's all about photography. Mm-hmm. It's not about the writing. I mean, like, that's a beautiful picture, but where's the story behind it? There is no story behind it. And that's the thing. And now it's all about, you know, the happy life, and, you know, it's really hard when you just, you know, when you show people the thing that... I mean, I don't know how to tell it. I mean, I don't know how to say it. I mean, just like it's...
So are you talking kind of specifically about Instagram when you're talking about that's a pretty picture? Like, when you're talking about these pictures, where are you seeing these images?
You know, it's all about the pretty pictures now. I mean, why do I have to make this recipe? I mean, what is the story behind it?
Right.
I mean, like, some people would disagree with me, which is totally fine, because then... You know, the thing is, like, people now, you know, perfection, it's so sad because, you know, everyone is aspiring for perfection and it sells. I mean, and it sells, but, you know, the thing is, like, when you just show a lot of perfection, which is the total opposite of you, you're hurting yourself as well, because that's not you.
So how do you show a more complex portrayal of yourself? On Instagram.
I mean, honestly, if I have the story to tell people, I would say it like, I share sadness, I share happiness, I share my thoughts. You know, some people would think it's some, like, you know, I have, you know, sometimes, like, I have negative thoughts, sometimes I have positive thoughts, but that's who I am, and that's, I'm a human being. I mean, I'm, I'm not happy all the time, and I'm not sad all the time. And I go through things, and I just share my experience because, you know, that's life.
I mean, Rachel, I'm curious, do you struggle sometimes to show that vulnerable side? Because I feel like, I don't know, I feel like maybe men are a little bit more comfortable sometimes not being the people pleasers that women often are.
You hit the nail on the head with that one. Yes, I absolutely do find it hard to express myself, like, yes, in person. It's easier for me to, like, talk about my feelings, but online, you know, if I do want to share a story, I write it, and I rewrite it, and I read it, and I'm like, is this going to make me look too soft? But, you know, I'm a tough person, and I'm like, over the past 2 years, I've begun to get a little bit more comfortable with that. Like, you also have to understand that. So if I share a vulnerable post and then I'm coming into work next day, it's like all of my colleagues know, right? Like, that's also a thing. When you're working for yourself, you're like, all right, I have put this piece out, vulnerable piece out into the world. I don't have to go and look at anybody tomorrow.
Yeah, I turn off my phone sometimes when I do that. I'm like, and now I'm turning off my phone and getting under the covers.
Exactly. So it's a delicate balance that it's going to take some more time for me to, you know, be truly a person who says what I feel and does not care. So it is a learning process. I try to do it more often now where I do share some vulnerable stories about myself and people love that. But yes, I have to go into work and meet people and, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, you're going through a hard time. Like, should we talk about it? I'm like, no, it's fine.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think one of the key differences between old media and new media is that pressure to put yourself into your work where as a food journalist 20 years ago, you were reporting on a subject, you were interviewing other people. It wasn't about you, but now so much of food media, and I think this has gone from the digital or new media, it's now kind of spread back into old media where people are writing columns from a much more personal perspective.
True.
My personal experience and my observation has been that those kinds of vulnerable posts on Instagram, on Facebook, on blogs tend to get more engagement. And so you have this sort of funny cycle where on the one hand, there's this pressure to put forward a perfect, glossy portrayal of your life and everything you cook tastes amazing and looks beautiful and is effortless and everything just works perfectly, which obviously is true for all of us all the time. But then on the other hand, there's real positive feedback or at least positive response to more vulnerable or more emotionally open posts.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Does that feel like a contradiction to you? Is that something that you struggle to navigate or not? Am I overthinking this?
No, you're not. I do struggle with that because life's a mess. And let's be real, it is. Like, everyone's trying to juggle all of these million things. It's not perfect. You know, one day this is going wrong, the other day that is going wrong. And the struggle with that is, like, not everybody wants to hear a sad story every day, right? And that's why I feel like you want to share, like, the perfect happy moments. But ever so often, I think it is important to share, like, the real messed up crap that's happening, because it happens to everybody.
Yeah.
And finding the right balance is important, I think.
And I think what you said about this idea of, like, with new media, how we are, like, inserting the I into the story. So it's like, if I screw up a cake, then I'm kind of like, well, where's my authority as someone who should be telling you how to bake a cake? if I'm sharing those moments where I screw up, it's kind of like, am I then, you know, taking away some of my credibility? And that's also something that, like, when you're in that frame of mind of you as a person versus you as a media company or you as a newspaper or a magazine, you know, it might be kind of funny if, like, I don't know, the New York Times Cooking does some, you know, oh, look at our different recipe developers and look at the flops that they've done, because it's like they have so much authority behind their brand.
I agree. No, I agree. That's the thing, though. Like, when people are like, oh, do your recipes, do you never make a mistake? I'm like, no, I absolutely make mistakes. But like Valerie said, it is like, do you show those mistakes? Does that make you less of an authority? Because already there's a tug of war between, like, who's the bigger authority? Is it traditional media? Or is it the online media, which is a lot of it right now? So
right.
Yeah.
And then the reality is, like, even the same publications might have different standards for what they put in print versus digital.
Yeah.
And that, like you mentioned, if you post something and go on to work the next day, it's the immediacy factor, yeah. right? It just all happens instantly. Whereas with print, it might come out like 9 months down the line
yeah.
where you've shared some really personal story, but there's been so much time
yeah.
that you've got like a healthy level of separation and detachment from it. And that's like, I mean, I think there's definitely still like a level of prestige that comes with something being in print, just because there is kind of like a different standard sometimes for what someone's going to publish.
Yes.
Yeah. I posted in Afghanistan a month ago, I went back to this little spice shop that I used to go to a lot when I lived in Kabul, and had a great relationship with the father and son who owned it. And I hadn't talked to them in 5 years since I moved away. And I went back to see them when I was there. But my wife, we got married this summer. She came into the shop with me, and I wrote, so in the Instagram post, whatever, I posted a picture of me with the two of them. And I wrote in the description, oh, my wife and I walked into the shop, and we had a very quiet wedding this summer. I didn't really tell a lot of people that we got married. And so then I had this whole funny experience where friends had read this post, which was not, I mean, and got distracted by the fact that I had called her my wife when I hadn't actually told them that we had gotten married. Anyway, I kind of stepped
like,
in.
You're like, what? What?
Yeah, exactly.
And you got a secret wedding.
Congratulations.
That's such a New York City thing, by the way.
A secret wedding. We just, like, didn't make a... It wasn't a secret. We just didn't make a big thing. Anyway.
You would have scared of the paparazzi, maybe?
It is a New York... Like, men getting secret married. I've only experienced that in New York City. Yes.
All right, we have a few minutes left. Let's do our rapid fire fun segment. Do you want to start? Should I start? I have a question for Rachel.
Yes.
What is a recipe that you've published or made recently that you were really proud of?
I would say the cucumber peanut salad in the summer.
Mm.
People
tell us more
it.
About that.
Why did they love it? What's so special about it?
I think it brought my kind of experience here in New York in the U.S. It tied it in nicely with my life and my culture back in India. So, you know, something as simple as cucumbers, so easily available in the summer, so it's like fresh local produce. And we don't really do dressings in India. It's basically lime juice and salt, but I kind of wanted to make it a little bit more robust and more dressing-like for my audiences here and people here. So I took the tadka technique from Indian cooking.
What's the tadka technique?
The tadka technique is when you temper whole or ground spices in hot oil or ghee.
Okay, and I've heard of that.
Yes. So that's how you usually start a lot of like stir fries and dishes in India. Sometimes it's used to finish things off. So you
dal.
Can use it a very yes, dal.
That's
various
kind of
different
a classic
ways.
Example. Yeah.
Yes. So. For the dressing, I kind of sautéed some cumin seeds with peanut oil and pour that over sliced cucumbers with some fresh cilantro and lime juice and salt, a little bit of honey, give all of that a toss.
And you brought a plate of this for us to try?
You have today. To come to the feed, I'll make it feed there.
Well, the feed is around the corner,
yes.
So we might take
so
you up on that offer,
week,
Rachel.
You are welcome anytime.
We'll be knocking on the door on Knickerbocker Avenue.
I would be happy to come.
And Majed, what's the best thing you've eaten on your visit to New York?
Oh, wow. Okay, I have to mention her because, you know, I've tried a lot of bakeries here, but this bakery specifically, like, just to blow me away with the dessert. I had the best donut in my life.
Uh-oh. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's by Chef Amber Ahmed in Mahzidar Bakery.
Mm.
I mean, the donut was... fried to perfection. I mean, it's filled with velvety vanilla pastry cream. You could see the vanilla seeds inside pastry cream. It's really, really good. I mean, and it's not too sweet, which is that's what I like. It's really, really good. I mean, very, very luscious.
I love that description.
Yeah, I want to go get one.
And that velvety, luscious cream.
Mazadar Bakery, right?
Yes.
All right.
I mean, now I just want a donut. Can we wrap it up? Rachel, one kitchen utensil you couldn't live without?
A shop knife.
That's a very chef-like answer.
We get that answer a lot.
That's a very classically trained culinary answer. What about you?
Do you have a style of knife, a shape of knife?
Yeah, I generally tend to like the more straighter chef knives. Like an 8-inch is the perfect one for me. So I don't like the ones that are like super U. Mm. And neither are the ones that are super straight. Like it has to have a slight curve. And like the sharpness of the blade should be towards one side, because like that gives you like a better grip when you're trying to cut.
The last time I was in India, I was really struck by the really long, skinny, very flexible knives that people use to cut fruit and I mean all kinds of crazy shapes.
You
gotta
look up a YouTube video on they cut onions with that, like the street food vendors, and it's a skill.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's like magic. I don't know how it happens. Majed, do you have a favorite kitchen tool?
Well, definitely like a mixer, but I would say
I love that answer. Yeah.
Okay, but
there Team
is some,
bake.
But there is a tool that's very fulfilling. I don't know if it's just like the spatula, like when you just scrub down the batter and like it's like something magical. It's like, I don't know, it's like
emotionally satisfying.
Yes, it's satisfying.
Yeah, I didn't know a rubber spatula could feel so good. I felt that. I mean, it is. It's very important. It's a very important tool that we use. But
or just when you work with the frosting, you just keep looking at it and just like, it's really really good.
It's like your paintbrush.
Yes.
With frosting.
Oh yeah. Okay, this is the conversation is starting a weird way.
One more question, Ethan. It's on you.
What did you eat for lunch as a kid growing up?
Good one.
It would usually be some handmade chapatis, dal fry, a little bit of rice, and a seasonal vegetable, and a homemade pickle made by my mom. I know, that's a lot, but yes.
Okay, we have something really traditional on UAE. We call it jashid. So it's a baby shark.
A baby shark. Like, do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah. But without the music. So we stir fry it with the spices and with onions and tomato and turmeric. And, you know, we serve it with the white rice and ghee.
Mm-hmm.
And probably some fresh onions. It's so good and so comforting. Mm. It's really, really good. Mm. I mean, baby shark meat is so delicious.
Are there any restaurants in New York that serve it?
Sadly.
All right, well, maybe you can...
You may visit us.
Yeah.
You should pay a visit to Dubai.
Just have some baby shark.
Yes.
It sounds like it's worth it.
Do you cook baby shark?
Yeah, we cook the baby shark.
But do you cook in addition to baking?
No.
Okay. I hear ya.
Before we wrap up, Majed, I want to make sure you have a moment to plug your book that you're working on. Do you want to?
Can you give us a general idea? Is it going to be baking? And
it's it's going to be a baking because
that's your
because everybody knows cook. That I'm it's going to be a Middle Eastern modern baking book. I'm really really inspired by Yota Maturenge and Helen Go sweet book, but I just want to take it in a different way. I just want to make a Middle Eastern dessert with like, or Western flavors probably. That's gonna be really, really, really cool.
Do you have an estimated release date or a timeline? When can people look for it?
Well, probably Valerie. You know, like baking, like creating a baker book takes more than a cookbook because you know baking. When you bake things, it takes like a long process to nail it. It's more like, you know. It's very, very chemical, I would say.
Yeah.
Yes. So we'll have you back
stay
on.
Tuned. Yes.
We'll have you back on
I'll be happy
in a
to
couple
be here
of
again.
Years.
Yes.
Yes.
And in the meantime, where can people find your work? Where can they read your blog? Where can they find you on social media?
You can find my recipes on thecinnaman.com and also my blog of the same name. My Instagram account of the same name.
CINNAMAN.
Yes.
Cinnaman.
And what about you, Rachel? Where can we find you?
you can find me on my Instagram named Rachel Gurjar, and I'm on the feed as well, doing videos and cooking.
All right.
Awesome. Well,
thank you both for joining us. It's been such a pleasure.
Pleasure is mine.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As always, you can reach us at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can find me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
You can find me on Instagram at Foodie in New York or my blog, foodieinnewyork.com.
And we are Why Food Podcast on Instagram. And if you have not already bought your ticket for the Heritage Radio Network's 10th anniversary gala, this is your last chance.
Woo,
your
woo,
last
I'll be chance. There.
We'll both be there.
We'll both be there.
Not
Amanda
talking to
will
each
be
other
there
because
too.
lots of cool people will be there.
Yes.
Including you, hopefully. You listener who I'm talking to right now. It's Monday, November 11th. You can buy tickets at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. Hope to see you there. And in the meantime, thanks to Amanda, our awesome sound engineer, and the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is Blind. Valerie, anything else?
That's it.
That's it. See you next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.